the Sustainable Hour.
For a green, clean, sustainable Geelong, the Sustainable Hour.
We'd like to acknowledge that we're broadcasting from the land of the Wadawurrung people. We pay tribute to their elders, past, present, and those that will come. We acknowledge that their land was never ceded. It was stolen by our first white colonisers, and there'll be no climate justice until we have justice for our First Nations brothers and sisters.
You are listening to the Sustainable Hour, and welcome, everyone. We are also becoming more and more the climate revolution because we've started a new series of podcast episodes that we call the Climate Revolution. And today in the Sustainable Hour, we have some guests that are going to expand on the topics that we talked about in the podcast that we put out last week. So everything is connected and coming around, but you'll hear a lot more about that after we have heard what's going on in the world, because as usual, we must begin with a little outlook, a global outlook from Colin. Colin, what do you have for us today?
Hello, Mick. Yes, of course. Well, we start with the news that Matthias Cormann, our former finance minister here in Australia, has become secretary, been voted the Secretary General of the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD. Now, that's an international institution that advises rich countries on their policy. And climate experts have expressed dismay at the choice of Matthias Cormann, because when he was part of our governments, right the way back to the Howard government, he consistently took a non-climate emergency stance. He voted against climate measures. And I have a quote here from Jennifer Morgan, who is Executive Director of Greenpeace International. She said, "We have little confidence in Cormann's ability to ensure the OECD is a leader in tackling the climate crisis when he has an atrocious record on the issue. We shall wait and see." I'm possibly of the opinion that he is a politician and he'll take which he thinks is the best one in his own interest. And the interest is switching. As you know, the climate emergency impetus has become something of a torrent now. He can get on board if he wants to. Another thing that's happened is that if you're wondering what happened in the case of Anjali Sharma, she was the school student who is taking our Environment Minister Susan Ley to court. That court case has been adjourned while the judge is making his decision. And that decision could come down anytime within the next 3 months. But for some reason, we're not hearing about it in the media. So I'll keep a little finger on that pulse and keep us with what's happening there. And then the other thing that I wanted to talk about this week is that John Kerry, who is Joe Biden's climate change envoy, went to the UK where he spoke to Boris Johnson and their climate change envoy too. And he was speaking, basically inviting them and turning the soil, I think you could say, for Joe Biden's climate change summit, which is coming on April the 22nd. And that's a summit where he wants nations to put in place the issues that they're going to be bringing up and cementing when it comes to the November Glasgow Paris Accord rethink. But one of the things that John Kerry said in the UK was that there are just 20 countries that put up 81% of the CO2 emissions. And those 20 countries are the ones who are going to need to do more. And he wants them to announce it in April and then put it into action in November. Well, those top 20 countries are headed by China, United States and India, and Australia is part of them. Australia comes in at number 16. So if anybody says to you, we are so small when it comes to emissions, we are not. We are in the 81% that is in the sights of John Kerry. And then he went on later to talk about the per capita, the nations that emit the most per capita. We come in at number 3 in that top 20 behind Saudi Arabia and Kazakhstan. So that's the company that we're in with at the moment. And John Kerry is aware of us, and we'd better start doing something. That's my world roundup for the week, Mick.
Listen to our Sustainable Hour for the future.
We've got three guests. Two of them are Aussies, and we've got a gentleman from Canada. But we'll start off with Peter Vardavalu, who is a forest activist, singer-songwriter, and we'll have a chat for Peter. And I think if we twist his arm, we'll probably be able to get a song out of him as well.
Lovely to be on the program again. Thanks, Tony. I'm going very well. We always have this slightly mixed feelings, don't we? I always find you've got, when you think about life in general, it's going well. And when you think about some specifics about life, like clearing the forest, biodiversity, climate change, etc., you think, no, life's going terribly, really. So try to keep the balance between those two emotions, I guess. I've got food on the table and a place to sleep, and I have musical instruments to play. So I've got to be very grateful and happy about that. But got to also be fired up enough to keep fighting for the planet, the species, all of the species, not just ours. Important days coming up on that topic on March the 21st. It is the United Nations International Day of Forests, and that was first proclaimed in 2012. It's a day to celebrate and raise awareness of the importance of all types of forests, and they encourage everybody around the world and organisations and governments, etc., to spend some time, particularly on that day, thinking about the importance of forests. And these days often are nice pointers for us to remind us of what's going on. In our own state of Victoria, before I go on, I'm coming to you from Bunurong country in the land of Naam, which is now more known as Melbourne, and Bunurong country, the particular area which is now known in Western languages is Carnegie in Victoria. Melbourne. So in Victoria, we've got some really, really terrible issues around forest clearing. So every 2 minutes in the whole of Australia, a size of the MCG is cleared. The forest area, the size of the MCG is cleared every 2 minutes. And I mean, there are stats, but when you just stop and think what really that means, it's just outrageous. One of our guests, John, from America. So the MCG is one of our biggest sporting arenas. For those who don't know what the MCG is, the Melbourne Cricket Ground, every 2 minutes, it is just terrible for the whole country. And in of the top 10 major deforestation regions around the world, only one of those top 10 is in a developed country. And guess which country it is? It's ours. It's Australia, and particularly along the eastern seaboard in the Queensland area. So, you know, we really have to lift our game. It's just not good enough. And it's, you know, governments are just very slack on proper legislation and enforcing legislation. So here in Victoria, we have this Vic Forests is the sort of government-run organisation that is given permission to log, and they're continually breaching their orders and logging in areas that have been declared to be protected areas. And wonderful, wonderful organisations like Save the Leadbeater's has been, via another brilliant organisation called Environmental Justice Australia, who are a bunch of lawyers who work virtually for no money to take Victorian government, various Australian governments to court to get injunctions. And so in about middle of last year, the Save the Leadbeater's group, the Assistance of Environmental Justice Australia lawyers, took Vic Forest to court and managed to get them to stop logging about 60 coupes in Victoria down in the Gippsland Way. So that was a really, really important case, a landmark case where, you know, it's all a little bit complicated legally, but basically they had the regional forest agreements which kind of tried to pretend they could override the national environmental laws and the federal environmental laws. And the judge there said, I don't think so, you can't do that. So that was a wonderful outcome, and the judge said, look, you know, yeah, you might lose a bit of money in the short term, Vic Forest, but we're talking about irreversible impact on extinction of leadbeater's and extinction of owls, and also climate change, which will be irreversible. So whilst you might lose a bit of money, Big Forest, I think the other matter is a bit more important, the other matters, so you have to stop now. So unfortunately, Big Forest have appealed that decision, and that's supposed to be being heard early this year. So that happened, you know, mid-late last year. So it was but it was fantastic. Hopefully the appeal will go down.
But Peter, who in their right mind? I don't get it. How can these people? We see what's going on with the climate at the moment, and we know how important the carbon sequestration is. It's something like 20% of the entire problem with climate change comes from the fact that we are chopping down trees. Because even if we plant new trees, you know how long time it takes before a tree really begins to sequester carbon? It takes years, it takes decades before the trees actually get up in the size where they take down some carbon. Yes. So what we need to do is to protect those trees that are already there doing the job. I just don't get how anyone in their right mind can be chopping down trees today.
It is just insane. I couldn't agree more with you, Mick. And you know, the terrible situation that we actually face with climate change today, as I think we all know, is even the bringing of emissions to zero emissions, that horse has bolted. It is no good going to zero emissions now. If we stop all emissions today, which we're clearly not going to, we will still have climate change baked in for 20 years. We've still got 20 years of climate change. So, it's not about zero emissions, which that's an important hallmark, obviously, an important goal. But we have to draw down. And currently, the best, the cheapest, the only proven technology for drawing down carbon is trees. And I must say also marine plants, seaweeds. Seaweeds are about 20 times. So mangroves and seaweeds, etc., are about 20 times more powerful at sequestering carbon than terrestrial plants. So yes, you're right, Mick. Firstly, we have to stop cutting them down. And secondly, we just have to plant squillions and protect all the areas that are under threat. But you have Vic Forests and you have, which is a government entity, for goodness sake. You know, it's not like the government can't control them. And I have a slightly dark and cynical part of me that, you know, it's all about money and power. And I think Vic Forests is, you know, pretty heavily run by unions, and unions run, you know, has huge influence on the Labor government, and then big business has a huge influence on the Liberal Party. And so when you say who in their right mind, well, you're exactly right. They're not in their right mind. They're after power. And wherever they can find their power vested, whichever organization, whether it's a union movement or whether it's a big business movement, they will fall that way. And I mean, it's so illogical. It's suicidal behavior, because, you know, it's this sort of pretending somehow that we are separate from nature. We are separate from we've got to save biodiversity. We are biodiversity. When you talk about saving biodiversity, you say it's saving us, ourselves, you know, and the incredible selfishness of it being that all of us will probably live and die without so much horrendous climate change effects. But it's the children and grandchildren, you know, for generations to come, they're the ones who are going to cop it the worst. So this incredible selfish behavior of this generation.
You're dead right, and you've put into words very neatly my feelings that have grown over 40 years, Peter. When I first came to Geelong in 1979, I was part of a large campaign that was called Don't Chip the Otways. And it was because the Otway rainforest, it surprises people. I'm sure it will surprise our guest from Canada, John, that we have a rainforest in Australia, the driest continent. We have one in Victoria, the Otway's rainforest. And the plan was then to cut down the old growth forests and wood chip it and send it to Japan to make Kleenex tissues. 40 years on, that's exactly what is happening. Every day, ships arrive at Geelong's port and they cart away wood chips from old growth forest in our rainforest. And part of that deal with Vic Forest was that it is being replaced in the rainforest with fast growing pines.
Colin, can I just bring in some facts there? And it's not fun facts. It's actually really devastating facts, because a week ago, data was released and it was out on Reuters, and it said humans have degraded or destroyed roughly 2/3 of the world's original tropical rainforest cover.
Yep.
2/3 of all the rainforest that we used to have on this planet is gone or degraded. That's the fact.
It's also very not in any way progress, because our water reserves, our reservoirs that feeds our city, comes from that rainforest, comes from the Otways rainforest. So we made that commercial decision 40 years ago, and we're living with it now. So we're with you all of the way, Peter.
And Peter, over to you again, because we need some advice. You are an activist. You're also an artist. Tell us a little bit about something that we can do.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point. And thanks, Colin, for those comments as well. And what you were saying before, Colin, about the purification of water by forests and how we're reliant on it, that's kind of linking into the comment I was saying before about somehow we forget we're animals. We're just animals, and we need clean air, we need clean water, or we're all going to die. And we think, oh, well, there's nature over there and there's us over here. We just look after us and everything. We are nature. Like, and we're just, and not forgetting, we're just one of the thousands and thousands of species. And if we make it inhabitable for ourselves, we're all going to die. I think it's really nice when we say things like, I've got to save the planet, but because it gives us a bit of focus, but and maybe takes away from us. But really, the planet will go on without us. Everything will go on without us. We'll just go. And so it's sort of this weird thing where we're not, you know, in some ways human beings are so incredibly selfish, particularly Western culture human beings, because, you know, indigenous cultures by and large, you know, they understood you have to live in harmony and with the environment, otherwise you will end up dying if you don't look after it. I mean, it's kind of the most simple of basic principles, isn't it? And the most fundamental and intelligent of basic principles. And we've lost it all, and pretending that we're separate. What we can do, there's just so much. Thank you, Mick. I think it's a really important thing for those of us in these sorts of areas. We can get in a bit of a downward spiral and end up going, well, it's all stuffed, you know. So lots of things. Firstly, Environmental Justice Australia is this brilliant legal entity, firm organisation of lawyers who fight heaps of cases on behalf of people like the Leadbeater's Possum. They've got three big cases that are going on at the moment. They're taking to federal court, based out of Victoria. They've got a Central Forest case going on at the moment, and they've managed to get an injunction on that one. It's called the Bushfires case, and they've managed to get an injunction on about I think 30 or 40 coops. They've managed to get an injunction for that, and they've got another case going in the courts called the Old Growth case. So if people want to do something, you know, one of the greatest things you can do, I know it sort of feels a bit funny and feels a bit like you want to be doing something more active, physically active, but just give them money, because if you give the experts money, they will run it for you, you know. And so that's a really important thing, I think. Email your politicians. In the end, contact your politicians, email them, phone them up, meet with them. In the end, they're power junkies. And if enough people, if they look like they're going to be unseated, they will make noise within their parties about we have to change our ways. So always remembering, Mick, the injunctions that Friends of Leadbeater's got, the injunctions that the Environmental Justice Australia group, the legal group, have got, that's people power. That's against the powers that be. It's against the governments. It's against big business. It's against many of the unions, because, of course, we have the forestry unions, etc., who are not very happy about, you know, stopping logging, right? So we've got lots of powerful interests. EJA, Environmental Justice Australia, all those kinds, that's people power. So what we can do is make sure we have as many people as we can activating and putting pressure on politicians, giving money to organisations that will fight on our behalf.
Terrific. And another thing, Peter, that people can do is write and sing songs. And we understand that you've got one ready for us right now.
Here's one I prepared earlier. It's called Fight for the Tree.
Well, upon Mount Reid, a pine tree stands. Northwest Tasmania, on Tomagini land, it's the oldest tree in our country. 2,000 rings it shows. It sprouted at the time of Christ, all those years ago. Nearby mines have come and gone, miracle it survived. Short-term greed all around scars the mountain sides. The mountain sides. Yes, scars the mountain sides. The mountain sides. Way up high near Talangi Town, the Kalapa giant stands. 400 years it's been growing on Woiwurrung land. Central Highlands mountain ash, precious as it comes, cleansing air and water, alchemists of the sun. But as I sing these giant trees, Hercules of nature, are being pulped into photocopy paper. Photocopy paper. Into photocopy paper. Yeah, reflex copy paper. How is it that we let this happen? It's a travesty. Out of sight, out of mind, we cannot let that be. The simple truth is that we can't live without the trees. 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 Sing with me. Gotta fight for the trees. Way up high on Capitol Hill, a big house stands. With red and green chambers on Gunna Wall land. Our so-called leaders riding high in their big charade. They let power plays and politics always win the day. They can dodge and weave and double speak as much as they please. But when will they face the fact? We can't live without the trees. 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 Sing with me. Gotta fight for the trees. Walk among the trees. Miracles of green. Walk among the trees. Our future's in their leaves. Walk among the trees. Feel their presence, feel their peace. Walk among the trees. One last time. Oh, we need the trees. Oh, we need the trees. trees. Oh, gotta fight for the trees.
The trees, man. You bet.
Thank you,
Peter. That is so good.
Thank you.
So
yeah,
good.
Man.
Yeah, we got it, had us all singing along.
Awesome.
And one thing we didn't mention is that we start the show with acknowledging country, and a lot of the trees that are being cleared are without. There are First Nations people that are fighting to protect them. So, yeah, this on so many levels, this is so wrong.
Exactly right. The recent Jabberong case in Victoria is just tragic.
Mm. At the same time, we're talking about having a treaty.
Don't know where to start with all of that. Yeah. The hypocrisy. So,
Peter, please stay with us, Peter.
Yeah,
I'd love to.
If you will, and we have many more. Well, we've got two more really interesting guests, and we would love you to interact with them as well.
I'd love to hear what they're Ellie and John, amazing people. I'd love to hear their take on things. So thank you. And thank you once again, Mick, Colin, Anthony, for having me on. You know, you guys are just legends. Thank you.
Hey, would you mind if we put your song on our website so people can download it should they need a protest song about trees?
Please do. Yeah. So and also, you know, my name's Peter Vadivelu, and you'll see it in the program notes, I gather, and I've got a website and Facebook page, and you can follow me on Twitter, you can follow me on Facebook, and you can follow me down the street if you like.
And many do, I understand.
Oh, we need the trees. Gotta fight for the trees.
Well, our next guest, Ellie Tucker, is involved in acting on your advice, the advice you give us from your song. Ellie leads up a team called Ecosystem Restoration Camps. We had Ellie on a while back, during last year, maybe during the COVID at its peak or round about then, talking about the first camp that they had up in northern New South Wales. So, Ellie, there's been some developments since then. So tell our listeners about where you're at the moment.
There has. Thanks, Tony. And thanks, Peter, for that song. I really love that. And I'm coming to, I'm streaming in from Woiwurrung country near Tallangi, actually. And I've seen... Yeah, the giant trees out there, they are absolutely spectacular. So I guess what you said, Tony, we're gearing up for our second project. So our first project was rather small, a bit of a test run just to test my organizing capabilities and learn a few lessons along the way, but now we're back in Victoria. The lockdown is eased for now, and I've been working in a community. My job is in, I'm a firefighter, and I also do community engagement for DELT, the Department of Environment, and also the Country Fire Authority here. And one of the communities that I work in is called St. Andrews. It's in Nillumbik Council Shire, and I've been driving through there, and every time I drive through there I just say, this is the place, this is the new ecosystem restoration camp location. For those of you who don't know, or maybe you live in Victoria but you're not quite sure where I'm talking about, it's probably about 45 minutes north of Melbourne. It's really beautiful, rolling sort of hillside, lots of steep terrain. It feeds, the waterways feed into the Yarra River, which for all the Victorians out there, you'd know that's kind of like the life stream of Melbourne, and everyone kind of, you know, can picnic and holiday along the Yarra. But it is gradually drying out. There's a lot of pollution happening, and one of the things that Oz Regen or our ecosystem restoration camps look at is hydrology and waterways. And Dave, who's kind of like this crazy guy that helps me run these camps, he has been studying the impacts of clearing on our water systems. And so really we're coming to understand more and more about water's role in climate change, how it's not necessarily the Western view of where there's rainforest will grow. It's, we're coming to understand now that it's really, you know, the indigenous populations had it right the whole time, that trees bring the rain. And, you know, living in Australia, we would know we're always, always fighting droughts and dryness. And now with all this clearing going on, especially, Pete, as you were saying, all up and down the East Coast, especially, and also in Victoria, well, really anywhere where we live, we're getting less and less rain every year. In fact, I'm 25 and I've never lived through a year of A, below average temperatures, or B, above average rainfall in Australia. This is kind of, you know, my life that I'm looking at, and we've decided if we're going to do something, it's the time's pretty much now. So, you know, instead of just planting a heap of trees and figuring, oh, it's going to be fine, the first step, I think, is to look at the watershed and look at the hydrology of the place and start building up succession planting. What I'm doing is I'm connecting groups, really. I'm reaching out to the Yarra River Keepers, the local land cares, the council, having a meeting with them. And really, I'm just kind of getting the word out there saying, I want to do a project. This is the right space. And then figure out, you know, okay, well, how are we all going to come together and make this happen? So I was telling Tony about the project and he was like, come on the show and we'll follow it. So I thought, yeah, this might actually be a good idea, because if anyone else is thinking of running their own restoration camp, then, you know, this might be a bit of a template. What do we do? So I'm hoping to come on every, you know, few weeks and give a bit of an update, and hopefully that'll keep me on track as well. So at least I'll be doing something in the meantime, because I'm going to have to report back to all your listeners on the Sustainable Hour.
I didn't have to twist your arm too much to get you to agree to that. But just on that, so, and following on from what Peter said about the rate at which we're cutting down trees, what you're saying is that contributes to the drought, that the unprecedented droughts that we've had.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And additionally to that, the drainage projects that we've implemented to clear land for agriculture, land that does fall inland, water that does fall inland now, if it, say, it took, you know, 60 to 100 days to get back out to the sea, our drainage is so effective, so efficient, that it will be back out to sea in a few days, and, you know, nothing really gets to absorb it. And you see that with the cleared forests, and you see that, you know, with the big bushfires that we just had, once the rain came, it didn't soak into the soil. There's nothing to keep it on the ground. It just all washes off. It washes out the topsoil off. It washes the seed bank off. And then what we're doing essentially is just speeding up desertification processes. And once we can't really live in a desert, it's, you know.
Yes, we understand the heat waves. We don't understand the implications and how it's slow and insidious, but it changes, climate changes on so many different levels. So where are you right now? If you're like coming to us every couple of months with a report, what's your initial one, please, Ellie?
I have a plan. I have a dream of this big ecosystem restoration camp. I've got meetings lined up with the council. I've got meetings lined up with the land cares. I've got a meeting with the Yarra River Keepers Association, which is really this huge, huge organisation with, you know, huge volunteer capacity. And then really what I'm looking for, what the next step will be, is scoping a property. I have a few in mind that I've driven past. but I'm hoping that the land cares, they would already know. I'm pretty new to the area, but the land care people would probably know people in that area who are kind of open to looking at hydrology and restoration works along the waterways.
So how can we help? Can we ask our listeners to get in touch with you? Should they think of a property?
Yes. If you know someone who's maybe, you know, up for a bit of a tree change and they're looking out at some of these properties out there and they're looking for some help, maybe they're battling some really bad erosion issues, you know, they've a bit overstocked on their grazing yards, the river's running dry, that's probably the biggest indicator that we can help. When we did this work out in Thora Valley, the results are almost instantaneous. When we were building up a leaky weir in the riverway, it, you know, the water is just trickling through this river, like, you know, just a few centimeters. And then by the end of the weekend, we built this leaky weir and we could already see that the water capacity had held. The next morning we had little baby frogs swimming around. It really is amazing and it's quite easy to do. So yeah, if any listeners have any ideas, absolutely get in touch. It's just ausregen@gmail.com, ausregen. And we also have a Facebook page as well.
That's fantastic stuff. Lots to, that you're touching on there so brilliantly. And I think that amazing point that I think many of us forget, and that trees bring rainfall, that it's part of what they do to the atmosphere that that creates clouds, that creates rain, and we are suffering drought after drought after drought. Again, just another, it's not just terrestrial in a sense of what trees are holding soil and holding nutrients and purifying water, etc., and the carbon sequestration. It's bringing rain and it's so important. Thank you.
Thanks, Peter. Yeah, that magical evapotranspiration. There's plenty of papers coming out at the moment, but if you look back in the literature before maybe 2005, it's really quite a new thing that scientists have been looking at. You know, Western science has really understood. I think probably the next few years we'll probably see more and more scientific understanding of how and why, but really I'm not that interested in the how and why. It's just we know it works, so we just need to get on with it.
Listen to our Sustainable Hour for the future.
Okay, now, John, you're probably shaking your head wondering what the hell are these Aussies up to.
I'd like to say something quickly to Ellie before you take me somewhere else.
Yeah, go.
While you're talking to us about hydrology, Ellie, I had this vision. I want to share it with you because I don't know if you've heard this sort of thing before or not, but it occurred to me while you were speaking about, you know, water that, you know, as, you know, Earth has given birth to us, in a weird way, it's our atmosphere that gives birth to fresh water. It all comes from there. You know, most of it comes from there. The salt, it takes water out of the salty sea and turns it into fresh drinking water. So I think we really have to honor the atmosphere because it's all one system, you know, it's all one. But, you know, I was just thinking about when, as you were speaking, how much I'm grateful for our atmosphere for bringing us all this beautiful fresh water.
The rivers in the sky. Yeah.
We're in a weird, weird situation at the moment where we don't value water one little bit. I don't know if it's the same with you in Canada, but here, petrol is cheaper than water. And that should never be the case. When you think that one of them is essential to us and the other one is a fossil resource that we shouldn't be burning at all if we were sensible.
John, please help me if I get the pronunciation wrong, but the way I hear it is John Lefebvre.
Well, we say Lefebvre. Ah, simple as that. Lefebvre. Yeah, in French, they would say something like Lefebvre, something like that. But in Canada, we're a little bit more kind of Yankee, and we just shorten it up and say Lefebvre. And yeah. I answer to that. Just don't call me late for supper.
Yes. You're a singer, a songwriter as well, and we're going to try and get one of your songs, but I understand your website is under construction or refurbishment at the moment, and it may not be available, but we'll do our best to get that on. The way I hear it is that you were made a killing, so to speak, out of the internet boom. Made lots of money.
You bet I did. A killing is a soft way of saying it. You know, I just about bumped Keanu Reeves off the richest Canadian. He was number 100 on the richest Canadians list at 300 million. And I pretty much bumped him off. But then I was arrested and that all went to hell.
Yes. And you've written about this in a book that has been very successful as well. Okay, so you've got all these millions of dollars. You went about getting rid of it as quickly as you could. And along the way, you had a conversion to environmentalism, or maybe you already had that, and it was fueled by the sudden access you had to money. So maybe if you can take us from there, or correct me if I've got some of that wrong.
Yeah, no, that's all absolutely right. And I'll say this, I was sensitive to the environment. I came into this money in around 2000, 2001, and I'm going to say 90% ignorant about it. And then I ran into an old friend of mine, Jim Hogan, who is very involved. Do people in Australia know who David Suzuki is?
Yeah.
Jim introduced me to David, and I've been a board member for David ever since. And so we've done lots of things together. It's been very intriguing. Jim and I started a thing called D-Smog Blog in 2004. And for a while, there was a dsmog.au. I think it might have faded away, but the slug line on dsmog blog was cleaning up the PR pollution that clouds climate science. The thing that Jim's genius was that he understood that really climate science is not, it's not a science problem, it's a PR problem. And Jim's a PR guy by profession. And, you know, what he recognized was a critical thing. And that is never talk to a climate science denier about science, because they have no interest in science whatsoever. They never do any science and they don't care about science. The only thing they care about is raising the level of doubt. And if they can just, they don't even have to prove anything. If they just raise the level of doubt, they have the effect of making us kind of stuck in the status quo. So that's what Jim and I in the DE Smog group kind of brought to the table. And scientists all over the world were very, very grateful to us for it, because, you know, they were spending, half of their career at that time responding to climate science deniers. And it's a complete waste of time. They don't care. They're just going to keep on doing what they're doing. The only thing you ever ask a climate science denier is where he got his money. And then they go mum. Right. And so we really were able to help change the conversation pretty dramatically with on that idea of Jim's. So we did that. But, you know, one of the things that coming into money, reminded me of is that, you know, wealth is a privilege and we are all very, very privileged. And I began to think about wealth as a an aspect of freedom. And you know, the freedom that we've all been touted since we were children. Remember when we were kids, they told us that freedom comes at a very high price. And I think what they meant was that freedom comes at the price of giving your life for, when we have to fight for freedom. Well, if you think about that for a minute, really what that means is about, you know, 0.001% of us pay for the freedom and the rest of us get it for free, because everybody else didn't have to die for it. But it became obvious to me that the true cost of freedom is much more expensive than that. And what I mean by that is every moment that we enjoy freedom, we have to strive. We have to pay for that freedom, earn it by striving to make sure that others who are not as fortunate in the freedom department get freedom too. And that's those dues never get fully paid. We pay them every day, and it's a huge, huge job. So, but what is freedom? You know, it really is almost synonymous to me with what I consider to be universal rights. It's all of the things that you and I take for granted in our day to day lives. We take it for granted that we're going to have security and respect. We take it for granted that we're going to have access to the tools of self-improvement, education, access to the tools of health, access to the basic finance and basic justice. And finally, and maybe most importantly, access to a clean environment. That is one of the most essential things about freedom. And so I think that when we are working to protect our environment, we're actually paying the dues of freedom every day. So I encourage you all to, I congratulate you all for not being, here's the little saying that you've avoided by doing that. People who accept the benefits of freedom, but are careless to others about others who are less fortunate in the freedom department, have not earned their freedom. They've only taken liberties. We have to pay the costs of our freedom every day, and it's a responsibility. So one of the things that, you know, you talked about me blowing through all my money, you know, the thing is, Anthony, that I got a little bit of notoriety for being, like, you know, aggressively generous. But if you think about what I've been saying to you, I think generosity is a duty. You know, wealth is a thing about freedom too. Wealth is really just another name for freedom in a way in our society. And, you know, if those who are happy with the wealth that has fallen in their lap, but disregard the situation for those who are not so fortunate in the wealth department, haven't earned their wealth. We have to all pay our fair share. All of these responsibilities, all of these fundamental rights that I think that we're entitled to universally, and I mean everywhere, not just Canada, not just Australia, I mean everywhere. Everybody's, I want you to think of it this way just for a moment. All of those things that we take for granted, if we can take them for granted as a right, it's impossible for me to figure out a successful way of distinguishing why, if they're our right, they're not everybody's right. And so the upshot of that is that we owe it, because we're free people, to strive every day to do everything we can to make sure others less fortunate in the freedom department get it too.
Well, that's wonderful, John. But can I ask you, as somebody who hasn't read your book and isn't part of the media that comes out of Canada, I don't really know where you spent your money. Can you give us a few ideas on just which organizations benefited from your wealth?
I've given several millions to the Suzuki Foundation. I was fortunate to meet a fellow you guys might know. His name is His Holiness the Dalai Lama. And I've met him now three or four times, and I donated money. He doesn't lend his name to much, but he very graciously allowed us in Vancouver to establish the Dalai Lama Center for Peace and Education. And the main punchline of that organization is education of the heart. You know, he reckons that if we teach children compassion, that's going to be, you know, the best that we can do. So that there's an organization in the eastern side of the United States called Future Generations. Daniel Taylor's a guy who runs that. Him and his father and his grandfather, they're all social work guys from Harvard. But and Future Generations does international development, and we donated about $6 or $8 million to them. The project that they brought up was called the Four Great Rivers. There are four rivers that originate in Tibet that feed about approximately a third of the world's population with fresh water. There's the Mekong, the Salween, the Brahmaputra, and the what's that great one, big one in India everybody knows Gandhi. About?
Ganges.
Yes, of course. And the Communist Party there, we talked them into making that area that is the source of all of those rivers a national park. And they played along with it because, for political reasons, but that's okay. I asked His Holiness about it, and he said, no, it's okay. You work with anybody. If it does good for Tibet, it doesn't matter who you do that work with. And so we did. And the biggest portion of the gifts I've given has just been to, you know, people that I've run into who need help, single moms that can't make rent, you know, people who can't get mortgages on their houses. I've probably lent, you know, I don't know, 100 mortgages for people to buy houses. And, you know, I was cleaning out the old garage I live in and cleaning out all the files just a few months ago. And there was these huge boxes full of like mortgage documents, and about half of them had the word forgiven written across them. So, you know, I just tried to help as many people as I could let me tell you this way. You know, I got loaded and I spent a whole bunch of money on property in Malibu Beach. And, you know, I fall for that, you know, Australian kind of beach dream the way Americans do. And I was really enchanted by the idea of Malibu. The rush of spending money is, I'm going to say, you know what? Hoarding money is the wet dream of wealth. You get all this money. There's no lasting thrill. There's no lasting benefit. There's no love grown, you know, and so the only way you can regain the rush, it's like dope, you know, you need more and more of it just to get the same rush again. And pretty soon you even become inured to that. But I recognize that when I gave money to people, the dividend of generosity never diminishes. Indeed, it grows. You know, I run into people all the time now that I don't even remember them. But they tell me 10 years ago, you saved my daughter's life. And I said, what do you mean I saved her life? Well, she got sick when she was down in Ecuador and she couldn't get home. And so you got us a plane ride up to, you know, or whatever, you know, so that, you know, those sorts of things. And those gifts just go on forever. And so my main point of this now, I really want people to understand that, first of all, Earth is the most fundamental basis of capital. You know, capital, we have to preserve our capital. Conservatives conserve capital. They conserve the money, yeah? But even more important than money is the property that gives off income, right? And the biggest unit of property that we have is Earth. The third thing that conservatives need to conserve is human resources. Human resources are maybe the most important element of capital. So these are the things that I try to encourage people to do. And you might think it's out of a spirit of generosity, but it's not really, because I think if we do these things, we're just all going to be way more wealthy in every category.
That's fantastic. John, I wanted to put your attention to that just last week, we put our second episode out of a podcast, which is called, or we call it, The Climate Revolution. And what we were saying last week is, you know, this revolution is going to be a revolution without smoke. We're not going to go out in the streets and burn tires. We're not even going to go out and protest. We are about collaboration and regeneration. And what you bring into the aspect there is generosity as well. And that's beautiful, because, you know, what we need is also innovation. We need to support those people who have minds to do good in any field and who innovate and make something better. Just like we've heard Ellie talk about eco-restoration camps and so on, and make the world a better place, not just for ourselves, you know, our own families and so on, but for humanity. And more than that, for everyone, like the koalas, the penguins, the ice bears, all the fish and all the little creatures in this world. So,
Mick, I want to say to you, do you know, before I was a director of the David Suzuki Foundation, you know who else was? Ray Anderson. So I know Ray Anderson, and I listened to that show. And bless your hearts for landing on Ray, because that man has a peculiar genius. And I was we were all so disappointed to find that he came to you know, an untimely end. But I was really knocked out about you guys that you had a show dedicated to Ray. So bless your hearts.
Peter.
Yeah, thanks for the great stories and what you're doing, John. It's wonderful. And I was just reflecting on that comment you made about a sense of duty, you know, and having yes. having that money and a sense of duty. And I think you're right. I think I wonder if there's another way of looking at it, just in the sense of also remembering that, like, we are social beings. We are so interdependent on everybody and everything in the planet. So, yes, while it's a sense of duty to look after people who have less than you, it's common sense. It's logical. Like, if we don't look after everybody, ultimately we are all going to lose. Everybody's going to lose. And I'm reminded of my sister-in-law. Her name is Naninuk Edwardson. She's a Nupiak First Nations person from Alaska. She lives in spends some of her time here in Melbourne and some of the time in Cape Barrow, the very most northern part of Alaska. And she says when they go out to, you know, they need food and they can't grow crops in Alaska, so they go out and hunt whales and seals, etc. All the sea captains go out and hunt for whales, and there might be, I don't know, 5 or 10 crews go out. It's likely you're only going to catch one whale. There's not squids of their own necessarily around. They bring the whale in, and it's just shared amongst the village. It's not that, oh, well, I've got the whale, I've got the resource, and I'm going to sell it to everybody now because I was the lucky one, you know. And it's like you're saying, it's a sense of duty. It's, well, if everybody doesn't eat, everybody loses. Everybody's going to die. It is a sense of, I'm just wondering if there's another expression. It's a sense of duty, but it's just like a common humanity around it, as well as a logic around it, because if everyone's not being fed, you can't live, none of us can live alone. So you need an infrastructure of society and community in order to survive. So a bit like you, your incredible situation where you got a lot of money and you spread it around, similarly, incredible situation, that sea captain just happened to be the one where the whale was, where his boat was. The other 5 or 10 weren't. Everybody gets that. They kill the whale, they bring it in, they feed it to everybody. Like, you were the lucky one at that moment. That captain was the lucky one, and you were, I mean, I'm sure you worked very hard as well, but just as these sea captains do.
No.
But, you know, you were the lucky one, and now you spread the wealth, because we all need that. That's just a logical thing to do, so that everybody is better off and everybody survives. Because when there are people not well off, everybody is, firstly, the humanity of it is tragic, but secondly, everybody is drained one way or another, spiritually, economically, environmentally, socially, etc.
I've done a lot of thinking about that, Peter, and I think you're absolutely right. And there's a whole bunch of reasons why being generous to people benefits us directly. And I'd like to spend some time on that, but I've realized we don't really have much time left here. So I don't want to be just going on and on. I'd like to just, see if there's any, you know, that sensibility that you recognize from the fishing village in the north of Alaska. It comes from First Nations people. I'll go quickly here, but do you know if you walk 10 miles a day, you can walk 336,000 miles a year, and in 10 years, you could walk 36,000 miles. How much is that? You can go from Lhasa in Tibet to Los Angeles, back to Lhasa, and back to Tibet again, or back to Los Angeles again in 10 years, right? And those people, and okay, new paragraph. A friend of mine gave me a picture book of photos of portraits of people from Tibet, and they look exactly like North American Plains First Nations people, right? And I'll tell you something that's exactly the same about those kinds of people. They all only care about two things: the Great Spirit and Earth that gave them their life. And in Asia, it's the Himalayan people. In North America, it's the First Nations people. I'm going to say they are the same people, and we need to learn from them. We have so much to learn from them, so much to learn. And then, in Asia, you've got the Han Chinese. They're just like us. We're just like the Han. We do all of the accounting and all the engineering and all of the bean counting and all of that BS, right? And we're very good at it. And we write symphonies. We're really, it's beautiful. It's a beautiful accomplishment, the intellectual accomplishments that we've come to in our cultures. But the thing that we lack more than anything else is proper respect for that other culture that probably gave birth to us. Right.
Mm. And it's, look, those parallels that you brought in between Asian and North American peoples fits just as well with our Australian First Peoples. We have 500 nations here, and they don't say they live on the earth. They are of the earth. Mm-hmm. That's the way that they have worked too. But look, if I can just come back and take you back by one quick one. You're talking about wealth. I, for my pains, spent quite a bit of time working for Mr. Rupert Murdoch, who is one of the richest men in the world.
It's got a nice
wife. Sorry about that. I do apologize. I will wash my mouth out afterwards. But I make the point that if it wasn't dollars that he was mounting up, if it was, for example, bicycles or television sets, say, and he said, I've got 450 television sets, but it's not enough. I need more. And I'm going to keep on going until I've got many, many more. And then I've got 45,000 television sets. I still need more. We would say you are demented. You've got a problem. You need help. But when it's dollars and money, we just say, oh, yeah, he's a rich person. And that happens again and again and again. So I applaud you mightily for your stance of saying, I've got enough money, I'll now use it for good. So thank you, John. Thank you very much indeed on behalf of the rest of us who don't have the money. Good With Money is the name of the book.
Good With Money. And that's because all of my friends said I wasn't good with money. Right? Good With Money, A Rich Guy's Guide to Gaining Everything by Losing It All.
Excellent.
So thanks very much. That's a very, it's a very generous compliment.
John, we live in a time where what we hear is that the stats say that across the world, there are more and more billionaires than there has ever been. Mm-hmm. That means, you know, wealth is concentrating at those very few people who have so much money that they could literally, you know, give away millions and millions and millions. They could even solve the crisis that we are in with the climate. They could solve it, and they would still have enough to live on the money. You know, there will still be millionaires.
We very rarely have the conversation about, do I have enough? I've got enough. I've actually got enough money to live. I can, for the rest of my life, I can feed myself. I can look after my, I can, we have enough. We never talk about when is the point when I have enough and then I can just give the excess away. It's like holding, grabbing more. It's like you were saying, John, I think it was a great analogy of an addict, because you get a little bit, you get a little bit of hit, and then you want more, but you need more the next time around to get the same hit. And it's a really, when do we say we've got enough? And it's sort of this infantile nature element of our society. It's like a three-year-old. You know, a three-year-old says, that's mine, that, you know, you see them, that, and but you grow through that. You know, you're supposed to grow through that and then go, no, I'm sharing my toys now. I'm not saying they're all mine. You know, you're supposed to grow through that. Somehow our culture, and I do believe very strongly that by and large Indigenous cultures have grown up, and our culture is infantile or juvenile and has not grown up enough to go, because that mentality is the one that leads to all our problems, because it's just the pure focus on accumulating money, which is by and large pointless. Once you can eat enough and you've got a nice place to live, you know, warm and dry, who cares, you know?
The beauty of the nations we were talking about before, the Alaskans and the Asians and the First Nations of Australia, is that they don't have money. It doesn't even fit into their way of thinking. That's why they can live very nicely helping each other, because they don't have that greed element that we worship in some ways.
Money is very, very important stuff, and I don't want to diss it. If we're going to take care of this planet, it's going to take a lot of money. And so, you know, the thing that I like to point out is I think wealth is actually infinite. And if we develop everybody on the planet, that's not going to cost us money. It's going to make us money. Everybody thinks that you can't have a successful economy unless you have growth. Guess what? 80% of the planet can be developed into being good customers for our computers. They don't want to buy Fords and trucks and big. What they want to do in Malawi is they want to learn how to use computers to make comics in Malawi. And then they can make comics in Malawi and they can take them down to the goddamn market and trade them for chickens and right? And they'll make shoes and people have nicer clothes and people, and wealth just explodes. So if we develop people, that's absolutely the best investment we can make for the growth of wealth.
Excellent.
And it's our responsibility to make sure that those billionaires, can you imagine those son of a bitches saying, if you tax my wealth 1%, that's going to be the end of everything. You know, that's going to be the end of everything. You know what? They've been pulling one off on us for 200 years. They tell us that only income should be taxed. You know what that means? Only working guys pay for the costs of the democratic institutions that make their money secure. We make sure that those guys hold all of that money securely with democratic institutions that working guys support, and those guys get it as a free service. Free service.
I should point out, I know we're out of time, but I want to make this point, John. You might not realize in Australia, we introduced a price on carbon, and that instigated a protest outside our Parliament House of billionaires holding placards saying no carbon tax. And our government listened and took it off again.
That's corrupt.
But we really did. We had half a dozen of our multi billionaires who were mining and fossil fuel miners, and our government listens to them when they protested.
Crybabies.
Well, the government listens. I mean, again, it's a systemic thing, isn't it? The government listens because they're the donors. And that's where our system is corrupt, and why we don't call that corruption out, because they are listening. You know, he who pays the piper calls the tune. So yep. They are saying, well, unless you look after me, you don't get your donation. And there's not very many political parties on the planet, and not many countries, but in our country we have at least one party who's saying the first thing we need to do is ban all donations. End of story. And yep. Of course, no major, and it's a minor party who's saying that. But of course, the majors are never going to do that because they will lose their power. It's baked in corruption in our Western political model.
Is why we suggest, when we talk about a climate revolution, we suggest next election, put your votes at those independent thinkers, those who have integrity. And that happens to be the independent candidates. It happens to be the small climate parties that are coming up. I just saw there's a new party coming in Germany. Last week, there was the announcement of a new climate party in Denmark. And we also have a climate emergency action party now in Australia. So these small parties are definitely worth noticing. But if you don't want to put your vote on the independents or on a little climate party, put it on the Greens. We have a party that has already last year suggested or proposed in the Australian Parliament that we should have a climate emergency law. You know, that it's called a bill when it's still a suggestion or a proposal, and then it's turned into an act. But that's what it basically is. It's a law. It's like taking the talk about the carbon tax back again and saying, yep, that's what we need. It's very simple. We can solve climate change. Super simple. Just make it expensive to pollute, and that would solve the problem right away. Over a decade, right?
You're exactly right, Mick. And when you were saying about what can we do, you asked me earlier. In my opinion, the most powerful, important thing we can do is who we vote for, because that's what makes the change. And, for example, you brought up the Greens Party. The Greens will never, in my opinion, ever have power in this country. But if 20 or 30% of the votes go to them, that's when the majors have to go, oh, my God, if we're going to lose power unless we bring in the policies of the Greens. So it's the way the Greens can dictate or not dictate, can influence. And it comes up to us, as you and me and our listeners, who we vote for is the most important thing that we can do to change the structure of our society.
Yeah, and we can do it. And I think we will do it. I'm predicting that it will happen already here in Australia at the next election. Certainly, if we could create more unity among ourselves, among the climate movement, among all the people who understand what's happening, if we had more confidence in that we can change the balance, if we actually believe that we can change the way Parliament works by simply all of us voting in the same direction. I'm not saying who to vote for. I'm just saying vote in that same direction. It's simple. Time is up for everyone. You talked about the end game, Peter. I think we have to say thank you so much to such an inspiring hour here. And the climate revolution will continue. And it will definitely contain these elements, what we have talked about. We need the trees. We need generosity, and we need regeneration.
I can't recall a more interesting sustainability hour. I've thoroughly enjoyed our talks with all of our guests today. Thank you very much, all of you.
Thanks for having
me. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you.
It's a great honor to be here.
And you guys are legends. you're magic.
Thanks, guys. Thanks
all right. So much. Bye, thanks, Colin.
Bye for now. The Sustainable Hour.
For a green, clean, sustainable Geelong, the Sustainable Hour.